This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here tonight with Tom.
How you guys doing?
We have two special guests, two great guys to take time out to talk to us tonight. First of all, we have Newell G. Bringhurst. Newell has a PhD and has recently retired from 25 years as an instructor of history and political science at the College of Sequoias in Visalia, is that how it's spelled?
Visalia, California.
Visalia, California, where he has lived with his wife, Marianne, and their daughter. Newell's the author or editor of numerous books, including Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, Excavating Mormon Past, the new
historiography.
Oh, you're going to have to help me. Of the last half century.
Yeah, the new historiography of the new Mormon historiography. I can't remember the exact title. I don't have it right in front of me, but
you write them, don't read them.
Yeah, well, it's a reference work, and it deals with the way that various interpretations of various aspects of Mormon past have evolved within the context of the so-called new Mormon history. That is the increased professionalization and scholarship that has developed since about the 1950s, over the last half century.
Great. And one that I read just a few months ago, Reconsidering No Man Knows My History. And the one we're focusing on tonight, Scattering of the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism, and the Mormon Quest for the Presidency. You're still an active member and a past president of both the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. Newell, welcome.
I'm not an active practicing Latter-day Saint. I guess I should point that out. I'm a member of record, although I'm not currently active practicing Latter-day Saint, although I come out of the Utah Mormon tradition.
Well, you and me both. Okay, and we also have John C. Hamer. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, Hamer, that's correct.
John C. Hamer, okay. You reside in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and currently the executive director of the John Whitmer Historical Association. And for those who aren't familiar, that association is backed or kind of derived or has its roots in the Community of Christ, the Reorganized Church. Is that right?
That's right. So essentially, it's the Midwestern version of MHA, the Mormon History Association.
Okay. And you're an independent researcher, historian, and map maker. You're the author and editor of books such as Northeast of Eden, A Historical Atlas of Missouri's Mormon Country, The Atlas of Mormon History, which is forthcoming, is that right?
Yeah, that one is long forthcoming. I've ended up putting that project off a little bit as I've been working on some other books. So the most recent book that I have my name on is I did the illustrations for History of the Kirtland Temple. We're coming out with a new illustrated history of the Community of Christ that'll be out in April, and then I'm also this year going to do another edited work on the Strangite Church.
Great. And of course, you collaborated with Newell Bringhurst on the book Scattering of the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism. And you've also written Strangites, The Great Lakes Mormon Experience.
Right, that's a forthcoming, like I say.
Okay, great. So welcome to the both of you. Well, why don't we just kind of start out with your work, Scattering of the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism, and tell us, maybe give us sort of an overview of that work.
Well, basically an edited work consisting of a series of essays by different authors, and the range of authors includes people that are either affiliated or have some kind of tie with Utah Mormonism or Midwestern Mormonism, and some of them are scholars that don't have an affiliation with either tradition. And the individual essays in the volume deal with different schismatic expressions of the Latter-day Saint movement or the Mormon movement as founded by Joseph Smith in 1830. And it does, you know, I hasten to point out that it doesn't cover all of the schismatic groups, because there have been over 400 schismatic groups that have emerged from the original church founded by Joseph Smith in 1830. But it does deal with most of the major ones, at least touches on them.
It's probably 400 and counting, I would suppose.
400 counting. I mean, yeah, that's very true, because there's still the schism is still taking place.
A lot of people probably aren't even very aware that there's more than one kind of Mormon. Usually, you know, the LDS Church is so well known that there's only, like, some, even among some Mormons, only kind of a vague awareness that there may be, you know, reorganized Mormons of some kind somewhere, the Community of Christ being the former Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then also fundamentalist Mormons have started to make the news, and so there's started to be an awareness that there are all these other traditions, but the traditions go right all the way back to the very beginning. Even in Joseph Smith's lifetime, there were numerous and also attempts to found kind of reform Mormon churches while he was alive.
So just today, if I understand right, the Community of Christ, the membership is around a few hundred thousand, is that right?
Well, it's about around 200,000, and that's an approximate ballpark figure. Isn't that right, John? Would you say about 200,000?
Yeah. And nobody else even approaches that size, do they, of
no.
The other schismatic groups?
Right.
No,
so then there's a couple in the whole universe. There's the LDS Church, which is in the millions, Community of Christ, which is in the hundreds of thousands, and then the next size down, there are about not quite a dozen different churches that have in the kind of 8 to 10,000 range or 6 to 10,000 range, and then it gets a lot smaller really fast. And so really, there's only we talked about 400. There's maybe 100 that are today around and large enough to field at least one congregation, so people who can all get together and meet in church. So some of them are as small as that, and of course then it gets all the way down to just individual believers who, you know, aren't in communion necessarily with anybody else besides themselves.
So schism sort of goes almost all the way back to the beginning, at least to Kirtland, doesn't it?
Well, it goes actually back to the 1830 in the founding of the church in New York, and the earliest movements that manifest themselves are within months after the formation of the so-called Church of Christ. That's what the original name of the LDS Church was. It was originally known as the Church of Christ. And almost immediately, there were dissidents, there were individuals that split off and said that they were founding their own separate groups. And that was present from the very beginning. So there was almost this inherent centrifugal force within the structure of Mormonism itself as founded by Joseph Smith.
And it seems to me that the earliest revelations Joseph Smith was receiving were sort of anti-schismatic also, containing the revelatory power in the hierarchy.
Yeah, well, the revelatory power within him. But, you know, that is actually, ironically enough, one of the causes of schism, the fact that Joseph claimed to be a revelator, to receive revelation directly from God. It was one of those things where other people said, well, if Joseph Smith can receive revelations, why can't we receive revelations? And there were many of the early dissident people who broke away claimed the same type of revelatory power that Joseph Smith was claiming. So the prophetic tradition, in a way, helped to spawn schism. Even though Joseph, tried to say, "Well, I have the superior power to receive revelation," he was never able to completely, legitimize that to the point where other people were intimidated not to receive revelation. And so, in a sense, when he tried to use it as a means of enhancing his power, it ironically would have just the opposite effect. Other dissidents would come forth and claim similar powers, and so that the revelatory, as we point out in our introduction, that was one of the causes of schism, this prophetic revelatory tradition within Mormonism.
just going to say, in the opposite end, having a prophet also caused schism because as time went on and Joseph Smith was constantly revealing new things, his part of the movement, we call the main line of the church, was continuously evolving. And so people who signed up in 1830 and joined, they, by the time 1835 rolled around, Mormonism was very, very different from what they had first been attracted to. And then by the time 1844 rolled around, things were really different from the way it had been in 18. And so all along, there were constantly people who, you know, wanted to go back to, you know, the kind of Mormonism that they first encountered and that attracted them to the church in the first place.
Yeah, we just last week we recorded an issue on the Expositor, and that was one of the things they put in there, that they wanted to go back to the way things were in an Expositor in Nauvoo.
And, of course, the Expositor was the organ of a Reformed Mormon church. I mean, that was...
Yeah. So you've got this church that's continually evolving and changing. I mean, that as John says, that really was a major, because Mormonism didn't stay static or didn't attempt to say these are the absolute tenets in which we believe. You know, the fact that, you know, plural marriage, for example. I mean, here Joseph Smith denounces it and condemns it. It's condemned and denounced in the Book of Mormon, but yet by the time that he comes forth with the Doctrine and Covenants 132, which commands plural marriage, that's at complete variance of what's in the in the Book of Mormon. That would probably be the most extreme example of a teaching or a tenet of Mormonism that evolves and, in fact, goes in a completely different direction.
Here's a question, since we're kind of leading up to the Nauvoo Expositor and that whole event. Is it true that most of the schisms actually happened after Joseph Smith's death? Isn't it that period between 1844 and approximately 1860 when most of the...
Go ahead. The biggest, there's a couple big events. So the first major event is 1837 with the collapse of the church in Kirtland. So with the failure of the bank, with the whole, half the original apostles, even more of the High Council, which at the time was a more important institution than the apostles, all of these guys were all disillusioned with what had happened with the bank and everything else like that. And so there was that led to a major episode. So all the witnesses, for example, between the collapse of the church in Kirtland and then the following year, the Mormon-Missouri War and the expulsion from Missouri, that led to a whole bunch of different churches being born, attempts to reform Mormonism. But then, like you say, after that moment, the huge, that has survived to this day, the next episode was 1844. So who would be Joseph Smith's successor?
And the failure of Joseph Smith to designate a clear successor was a major factor in the splintering and the fragmentation that took place within Mormonism. His failure to designate who would succeed him in case something did indeed happen to him, and that's why you have one writer, I think it's Steve Shields, who's an expert on schism, has called this the era of fragmentation, specifically the period between 1844, Joseph Smith's death, and the coming together and formation of the reorganized church in 1860 was this period of critical fragmentation in which, according to another writer, at least 14 major expressions of Mormonism manifested themselves during this period.
I think that following Joseph Smith's death, that's probably one of the biggest events there. Why don't you, maybe John Hammer, walk us through a little bit with James Strang and the creation of the RLDS Church a little bit.
Sure. So immediately with Joseph Smith's death, the two major rivals are Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young, and the other person that would have been involved in that would have been William Marks, who was the presiding the president of the Central Stake, but he sided with Rigdon. So right away there's that rivalry. Young, Brigham Young is able to convince the people at headquarters to back him. Sidney Rigdon leaves the city and reorganizes church in Pittsburgh. And so he starts to gather most of all of the dissenters and everybody around him. But as often happens when people set up a schismatic church or a new organization and they decide to go back to some earlier form of Mormonism, wherever they decide something went off the rails, you start to go back and back and back, and you start throwing things out, and you can't ever decide when to stop. And so at a certain point, Sidney Rigdon's organization almost entirely dissolves and atomizes, and almost all of these guys get thrown off in different directions, and there start to be lots of different rival claimants. Kind of at this moment, a very unexpected claimant happens in the form of James J. Strang, who is a relatively recent convert to the church, who lives up in the Wisconsin Territory. And he announces that at the moment of Joseph Smith's death, an angel appeared to him and ordained him to be Joseph Smith's successor, and then he also produced a letter which he said was from Joseph Smith designating him to be the successor. And so this is a kind of a startling claim for a lot of people. Most people don't initially think anything of it, but once he starts to demonstrate prophetic abilities, it starts to impress people. So he finds a set of plates, he translates those. There's all sorts of other things that he does, and he starts rallying lots of these core leaders, dissenters especially, anybody who doesn't really like Brigham Young, start to rally around him, and then that becomes the strongest rival organization. James Strang then ultimately moves to Beaver Island, where he reestablishes some of the press that Joseph had done in Nauvoo, including plural marriage and establishing the kingdom of God on earth. And so he's crowned king, and he has his own kind of very successful Mormon kingdom. But then it ultimately falls prey to the same kind of problem that the Mormons faced in Missouri and Illinois, where the neighbors, the Gentiles on the neighboring island, attack him. Strang gets assassinated, all the people get thrown out, and the church essentially dissolves. And then it's continued to exist to this day, but in a very small form. Relatively, there's only about 200 Strangites left. And so in the meantime, then, there's been lots and lots of Midwestern Mormons who kind of find themselves without a church. Primarily, these people have been opponents of polygamy. They have been upset that Brigham Young came out as openly practicing, and they also opposed James Strang. And so these people are looking for a new leader, and they hope it will be Joseph Smith's son. People try to persuade Joseph Smith's son to take over as his father's role. He won't do that, he says, unless he feels called by God. There's no point, he thinks, in claiming you're a prophet unless you feel that you have been called to do so. And then ultimately, in 1860, he reports that he has had that manifestation, so he comes forward and is ordained prophet of what becomes the reorganized church.
Now, there are accusations and back accusations about the ordination of or the blessing that his father, Joseph Smith, gave to him when he was young. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Well, there's controversy because they've never been able to produce a definitive copy of the actual blessing, although that was, as you might recall, that was one of the documents that Mark Hoffman actually concocted, and it raised a lot of eyebrows when Hoffman emerged. But there are, you know, the RLDS, or today the Community of Christ, strongly believe that Joseph Senior, or Joseph Smith Junior, designated his son Joseph Smith III to be his successor, whereas Utah Mormons, of course, reject that claim because they said there's no, documentary or definitive proof that indeed was the case, and so the reliance is often on the recollections of others who make that claim on behalf of Gilbert III and the reorganized church.
Now, D. Michael Quinn would have us at least believe that Brigham Young might have thought that for a while, that he might have had...
Well, yeah, there's evidence. I mean, that's what muddies the claim even further, is because there's evidence that Brigham Young, and more evidence is coming out, and especially with this new multi-volume work that just recently been published by Signature Books, which indicates that Brigham Young, in public sermons, you know, even made the statements that holding out the possibility that either Joseph III or one of the other sons, maybe David Hiram, which should maybe come forth, would at a future date come forth as the as new prophet, seer, and revelator. I mean, there was that he never completely discounted that, and so there are indications that, you know, because Brigham Young he was not actually sustained as president of the, you know, as prophet, seer, and revelator of the Utah Church until 1847. But even after that, there are indications that he was holding out the possibility that one of the sons of Joseph Smith would indeed become president of the church.
And actually, that was common in a lot of the different movements. So James Strang also said that one day, one of the sons of Joseph Smith might be, you know, become his successor, Lyman White, who had a very successful colony. He had been an apostle, and he had a very successful colony of Mormons in Texas, believed that, Joseph Smith III would be the prophet. Alpheus Cutler, who also had a branch of the church, his own church, the Cutlerites, he and George Miller, who had both kind of gone with the Utah Mormons on their way, on their trek west, but they stopped in Iowa over this question of a first presidency, in part, and because they didn't think that Brigham Young should have formed a first presidency. They thought that in Lyman White's case and in George Miller's case, they felt that that the successor was going to be Joseph III. So this was a commonly held idea, but like Newell says, it's not like there's any, we don't have the blessing, there's no documentation other than people saying that they heard it, or they believed that.
The Lyman White story is actually pretty fascinating, because isn't there documentation that Joseph Smith, while he was still alive, actually talked about the idea of moving the church to Texas?
Yes, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that was a very, very strong option that Joseph Smith himself was considering. And he actually had been in contact and communication with Texas authorities, because at that time Texas was an independent nation. It hadn't been yet annexed to the United States, and that's what made it attractive, as, you know, that literally the Mormons would be leaving the United States if they could get a grant from Sam Houston, who was the president of the Texas Republican. And Joseph actually sent delegates down, or sent representatives on envoys on behalf of the church to negotiate and discuss this possibility. In fact, one of the essays in our volume, the essay by Michael Scott Van Wagman, specifically discusses Lyman White and the Texas option of 1844, and it was truly a forgotten Mormon alternative, and it's a fast story, because it helped to give legitimacy to, you know, the movement that White himself, you know, because he said White claimed to his dying day that he was fulfilling the deep held wishes of Joseph Smith, that the Mormons should immigrate to Texas.
Well, and Brigham hesitated for a few years before he excommunicated him, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, yeah, it came at a later date. Because there was because White had made such a strong case, and there was the evidence to support Joseph's intentions had been in that regard.
So now, it's always been interesting to me about the saints that were left in Kirtland, because if I remember right, what's his name? The witness of the Book
Martin
of
Mormon. Harris.
Martin Harris stayed in Kirtland for quite a while, and I think he said something to the effect of, "I didn't leave the church left me." What happened to those saints who were left in Kirtland when the church sort of kind of dissolved in Nauvoo?
Well, so I think that I think it might have been David Whitmer who said it. Is he the one who said it? Was it David Whitmer? Anyway, so I think a lot of people felt like that they didn't leave the church left them. So Martin Harris and a lot of the people, Martin Harris and those folks are left in Kirtland. There remains a community of Book of Mormon believers, of Mormon believers in Kirtland. And essentially what happens is that anytime different organizations would send missionaries through, they would usually be able to get all the old saints back together. They'd all meet in the temple. They'd all kind of declare themselves for the organization that had sent representatives, and they would start to organize and meet and things like that. So, for example, James Strang went to Kirtland. He held a big conference in the temple. They gathered all the saints back together, including Martin Harris and everybody else, and they organized a new stake presidency, all that kind of thing. And then, he left. He went back to wherever he was, and they would take the newspaper from him for a while, and then after a while that would break down and somebody else would come through. And so there were, probably three or four different organizations that kind of arose and fell in Kirtland until ultimately the reorganization sent people there, and the people more or less that were left mostly joined the RLDS Church, and then ultimately the temple was reclaimed by the RLDS Church. They still own it today, the Community of Christ. But the same thing happened with the Whitmers in Missouri. So a lot of the witnesses that had gotten left in Missouri, the Whitmers, continued to believe in kind of an old style of Mormonism. So David Whitmer, John Whitmer, had a church which they called the Church of Christ after the original name of the church. The leaders of the church were the first elder and the second elder the same way. Those were Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith's titles in the original church, and they received revelations using seer stones.
Wow.
So they continued to kind of want to embrace a version of Mormonism that was the version that they had first encountered.
So we spoke of the reorganized church retaining control of the Kirtland Temple. Most Mormons know that the Salt Lake branch doesn't hold all the temple, all the property in Missouri, and it's kind of sort of divided up between more than one organization. Maybe we can talk about the organizations that sort of hold land there on the old temple site in Independence.
Well, yeah, there's a whole array of groups, and that's what makes Independence such a fascinating place. It was designated as the old McGathering place where in the early church by Joseph Smith, is where the saints were going to gather in preparation for the millennium and the second coming. And so that's what gives Independence such a special significance. And so that's why so many of the, all of the major groups and a number of the minor ones have established congregations or headquarters or whatever in and around Independence. The Cutlerites, or you've got the Temple Lot group, which is across the street from where the RLDS temple is, and you've got, of course, the Utah Mormons, who have a visitor center that's located adjacent to the RLDS, and of course the RLDS also have their world headquarters there, their auditorium and their world headquarters, as well as their temple. And then on the other side of the street, you've got a group that has broken off, which is under the direction of Fred Larson, and they're known as the God help me out, John.
The Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
The Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they're one of the numerous groups that have broken off from the RLDS or the Community of Christ. Much of the schism or heavy fragmentation of schism within the RLDS or Community of Christ was engendered in large measure by the reorganized church granting, you know, ordaining women to the priesthood starting in the mid-1980s. And that's kind of an interesting story, and that's also discussed in our volume by, to some extent, by David Hallett. He talks about these various groups, and that's where a major schism, sort of analogous to what happened in Utah Church when in 1890 the manifesto was brought forth saying that the church would no longer practice polygamy. That engendered the schisms which emerged as leading to, you know, the various fundamentalist Mormon groups.
We talk about the temple site, but there were actually supposed to be 24 temples, if I remember correctly. But they did lay a cornerstone. Who controls the cornerstone lot?
Well, the original, so they have an original dedication ceremony, and they do it on a plot of land that the early Mormons don't actually even own yet. But that later is purchased by the first presiding bishop of the church, and it's a 63-acre parcel, approximately a little bit more than that, that's on the old Santa Fe Trail, just barely west of what was then Independence, is now right more or less just in downtown Independence. And so of that parcel, that's split into four pieces, three different churches own part of that. So the Community of Christ, the LDS Church, and then the Church of Christ Temple Lot. The Church of Christ Temple Lot has the most important aspect of it, or the most important part, which is the traditional spot of the dedication that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and everybody did for the very first of those 24 temples. So the temples would fill up most of that that parcel according to the plan, but the very first one that was going to be dedicated is traditionally, we don't know for sure, but anyway, it's traditionally the little part of it that the Church of Christ Temple Lot owns. And so that group, the Church of Christ Temple Lot, is a group of Midwestern Mormons from Illinois originally, who after the majority of the saints have gone to Utah, they are opposed to polygamy, so they didn't want to go with Brigham Young. They were also opposed to polygamy with James Strang. But they are also opposed to the idea of lineal succession. So they do not think that a son of Joseph Smith should be the head of the church. And so after the reorganization happens, they themselves reorganize themselves as a church of Christ, as the Church of Christ. And they, one of the old apostles, John E. Page, ordains one of their members, Granville Hedrick, to be prophet, seer, revelator over the church, and he then has a revelation that they should go back to Independence and reclaim the temple lot, which they do in the 1870s.
This whole temple lot area is really fascinating because it seems like there's so many branches in such a small, limited area there. Do most of the branches that kind of reside in Independence or around the temple lot, do they look at the mainstream LDS church as kind of the big bully? I mean, because if the mainstream LDS church can buy and renovate most of downtown Salt Lake, couldn't they just go over there and just buy up all that property? Or is there been like any problems that those little branches have had of keeping their property against the LDS church?
Well, the temple parcel itself is already owned by people, and I mean the LDS church owns its own share of it. It would be impossible to buy it from anybody because nobody would sell. So the Temple Lot Church absolutely will not ever sell the Temple Lot to anybody under any circumstances, and they also have it as kind of an article of faith that they will not mortgage it. They won't, you know, it's not going to be in danger. They're still quite viable. They probably have a few thousand members, maybe, I think even including international members, maybe 6,000 members, so they're going pretty well, pretty strong, and we don't expect that they'll peter out anytime soon, so I think they're just fine. In terms of like the immediate vicinity, almost all of that land is owned by the Community of Christ, a lot of those houses and everything like that, so they would have to sell it to the LDS Church. Obviously the church has more money than anybody by far, but I don't think that they've had any particular goal of buying in Independence itself. Almost all of the LDS purchasing is, I think, takes place north of Kansas City, up by where the new LDS temple is going to be in Kansas City. So it's, that's in near near Liberty, where Liberty Jail was with
Joseph
Smith.
Yeah, the largest purchases that the Utah Latter-day Saint Church has made has been up in around far west, and that's where Joseph Smith was going to build another temple. You know, in fact, they laid the four cornerstones there at far west, and the LDS Church owns quite a large, significant pieces of land. And of course, as John said, they own the Liberty Jail, you know, the Liberty Jail and that as well. And so, and part of that is because, you know, our LDS have had that. They've got some land up there. They've got a small congregation, a small church, and some land that's across the street, immediately across the street from the temple site at Far West. But I don't think they've got much more land than that, do they? You know more about that than I do, John.
Not in Far West. Well, the Community of Christ also has the Hans Mill Massacre site anyway, but then the LDS Church has Adam on Diamond. So there's, anyway, I would say on the question, though, that you had about being seen as a bully or people, I mean, what all of the smaller churches always have to deal with is when they're going around and, explaining or sharing the restored gospel and evangelizing, going on missions and things like that, they always have to, you know, when they're saying, you know, talking about the Book of Mormon, they always have to say, here, you know, yes, we believe in the Book of Mormon. No, we're not the Mormons or whatever. We're not the members of the LDS Church. So everybody always has to, it is a complicated thing that you have to explain to everybody. I want to share the Book of Mormon with you, but I'm not, I'm not the Mormons or whatever. You know, how do you explain that?
That's been the big problem with particularly the RLDS, now the Community of Christ. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the Community of Christ has changed its name, because they were always in the position of saying, we are not Utah Mormons, even though we have a name that sounds very much like the Utah Mormon name, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they're making a concerted effort to make their identity clear. It's kind of a fine line, because on the one hand they want to identify themselves as separate and distinct from the Utah Church, but there's also that element within the Community of Christ, which there's still a part of that original Latter-day Saint tradition, because up until very recently, the leader of the RLDS Church was always a descendant of Joseph Smith. Up until W. Wallace Smith, Wallace B. Smith was the last direct descendant. He was the great grandson of Joseph Smith, the prophet, and so they've got that lingering identity, and then they still believe that the Book of Mormon is canonized scripture within the Community of Christ. So they still have the tradition of the Book of Mormon, as well as the Doctrine and Covenants, and those are two elements that are also within the Utah, both canonized scripture as with the Utah Church, and so. It's this dilemma of trying to differentiate the Utah Church while at the same time dealing with the fact that they're part of the same tradition.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, their view of things like the Book of Mormon these days is much more nuanced than the Salt Lake Branch.
Yeah, they consider it. I mean, there isn't a consistent position within the Community of Christ, because there's a much more diversity of opinion. There's a greater tolerance for differing views and a diversity of opinion among members of the Reorganized Church, or Community of Christ as it's now known, than among Utah Mormons. And that's partly due to the fact that they've always had this membership that has a tradition of kind of being descending, coming out of a descending tradition, going back to their formation in 1860.
So moving west to Utah, I know there was some pressure by some individuals in the church who wanted to move on to California. Was there ever any sort of schismatic movement that moved west further?
Well, there's one interesting case. I live out here in California, and that involves the case of Sam Brannan, who's kind of a colorful, controversial figure. He actually arrived in San Francisco, which was actually known as Yorba Buena, back in 1846, right after it was annexed to the United States as a result of the Mexican-American War. He lands in San Francisco with a group of around 200 Latter-day Saints, and he arrives there before, you know, a year before Brigham Young arrives out in Utah in 1847. And actually, Brannan wanted wanted Brigham Young to bring the Saints out to California. It would be a much more ideal and congenial place for the church to exist out in California. And he actually travels back. He backtracks along the, he goes backwards along the trail to California, along the California Trail, and meets up with Brigham Young somewhere in Wyoming. And here he is trying to talk Brigham Young, say, hey, you don't want to stop in the Great Basin or in Utah. Why don't you come on out to California? There's so much more going on out there. And Brigham Young, of course, he rejects that because he says, if we go out to California, there's all these non-Mormons that are already out there. And this is even before the discovery of gold in 1848. He says that we're going to run into the same problems that we ran into in Illinois, in Missouri, in Ohio. We'll end up being driven out of there, whereas in the Great Basin, we'll be able to establish a kingdom where not even the devil will be able to drive us out. You know, I'm paraphrasing what Brigham Young says. And so he rejects Sam Brannan's overtures to bring, you know, because Brannan is the leader of those Mormons who came across. They came by ocean. They went around Cape Horn around South America. It was a perilous voyage that they took in 1846. And as I say, Brannan really wants the rest of the Saints to come out to California. Brigham Young rejects that. Brannan goes back, and he becomes a very wealthy man. He only leaves the Utah or the Mormonism and becomes California's first millionaire and becomes very secular in his behavior.
Now, when the Mormons colonized, they colonized all the way down through the corridor, down to Las Vegas into San Bernardino.
Yes, that came later. That came, and that was under the leadership of people like Amasa Lyman and Charles Rich. That colonization comes as a result of, you know, Brigham Young has this grand vision of the state of Deseret, which will also give them a port in the San Diego, Los Angeles area. If Brigham Young had been able to have his way, all of that would have been part of Mormon-controlled territory. And that's his original conception when he sends that colonization of the San Bernardino. And that becomes the second largest settlement for a while next to Salt Lake City. And then that, of course, is abandoned in, you know, when the Utah War comes along. And by that time, California is formed. And Utah, the territory of Utah is much smaller than the original state of Deseret, which Brigham Young wanted to have. You know, the original state of Deseret would have covered pretty much all of California, Nevada, a large swath of New Mexico, what today be Arizona, up into Colorado. It was a huge swath of land, and if Brigham Young could have pulled it off, he would have had really a huge piece of real estate.
And to me, that seems more in line with what Joseph was hinting at before he died. You know, he talked about controlling the West with the 150,000 troops.
Yeah, that was, in a way, it was in many ways a fulfillment of Joseph's original vision.
Well, let's look at, I'm sure that most of our audience is probably thinking, what about the FLDS, since a lot of times the FLDS is in the news. What about that schism? Can you guys talk about that a little bit? Did it start when the mainstream LDS church broke its ties with polygamy in 1890?
Yeah, the genesis of that, that's when the genesis of it comes about. Actually, the people that become involved with the whole fundamentalist Mormon movement, as far as the FLDS, it wasn't reformed. You know, there wasn't formally what is known as a fundamentalist church, Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That wasn't actually formed as a formal church, actually until the 1990s, believe it or not. But as far as fundamentalist Mormonism, that goes back actually to the manifesto of 1890. And there's a claim among the people that are adherents to the fundamentalists that that John Taylor had a revelation in 1887 in which he indicated that the mainline church was going to abandon polygamy, and that in order to follow the commandments of God, the practice of polygamy would have to continue, because after all it was canonized in Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And so the genesis of that starts, but the actual formal formation of specific definable movements, it evolves slowly during the 1930s and the 1940s, and then you get the two major groups that are formed are. Eventually there's a group under the leadership of Reuben Allred, and then there's the emergence of another group under Leroy Johnson, a group that had their headquarters down in what then was known as Short Creek, now known as Colorado City. And so there were two major manifestations of it: the Allred group, which primarily was centered around the Salt Lake Valley, and then the Short Creek or related to Colorado City group, which is down in Arizona and Utah, Hillsdale, Colorado City.
So how big of a factor was polygamy in the wide scheme of the schisms within Mormonism, really?
Pardon?
Certain doctrines or teachings within Mormonism, do you think polygamy was the most contributing factor within, breakoffs and stuff, even from when Joseph Smith was still alive?
With regard to the fundamentals, yes, of course, it was primary, but there were other teachings that they brought forth, which they felt that the mainline Utah Mormon Church was departing from. For instance, a sense of communitarianism, the communal. The holding of property by the larger community, that's also a very important cornerstone of what is the fundamentalist movement today. And the other strong belief is a sense of the approaching millennium or apocalyptic beliefs that the end of the world is not far off. That's another tenet. And then there's a racial component too. After the revelation of 1978 granting blacks the priesthood, they strongly believe in the inherent inferiority. They have a strong sense of inherent inferiority of black people, and in fact of all, pretty much all dark skinned people. There's that strong racist component, and that has been emphasized particularly since 1978. So, the practice of plural marriage is certainly, a keystone, but there's these other factors, and they feel like they're actually practicing pure, the old-time Mormonism as practiced by the 19th century Mormons prior to the Manifesto.
What I find kind of interesting about these groups is, instead of having, like a huge schism and a break, especially in the first half of the 20th century, they sort of lived in the shadows, and often
and that's very true. And in fact, that to some extent, there are still what you would call closet polygamists that still kind of live on both sides of the street. They consider themselves members of the LDS Church, the big church, and at the same time. Feel that practicing polygamy is divinely sanctioned, and it's almost like there's a subculture within mainstream Mormonism of those types of people. In fact, again, referring to our Scattering the Saints volume, Craig L. Foster in his examination of plural marriage talks about the persistence of plural marriage within mainstream Mormonism. And in fact, one of my ancestors, a great aunt. She entered into a post-manifesto marriage in in the early 1900s, and she was with somebody who was a mainstream Latter-day Saint.
Yeah, one of the reasons why that all happened and why it was so slow to emerge was that it was a fundamental tenet of most fundamentalist Mormons that the LDS Church remained the church. So they, when they were in, they were out of communion with the church, it wasn't because it wasn't the church. It was that the church itself, and they had their own different church. It was the LDS Church was the church. It was simply in a condition of disorganization or disorder. And what continued to exist was the kingdom and the priesthood. And so they would maintain the gospel and the priesthood. In Mormonism, the priesthood was established or restored, you know, a year or so before the church was restored. So the priesthood obviously can exist without the church. So they continued to be led by priesthoods. And then it was only really much more recently, and I think it might have been timed, as Newell was saying, with the 1978 revelation or so, that that fundamentalist groups have started to decide, well, in fact, the church is so far out of, you know, so far into disorder that it's important to organize a new church, which then the Short Creek group did by incorporating as the FLDS Church. And then I don't think, though, that I think that the larger group, the one in Salt Lake Valley, the Apostolic United Brethren, I think that they all have not, though, organized as a church yet. They may still be maintaining that same view that the church is just in a condition of disorganization.
Yeah, it's interesting because I interviewed a member or one of the officials of the All Red group. They have a settlement up in Montana, Pinesdale, Montana, and I sat down and had a long conversation with his name was Jessup, and he was the principal leader of the All Red group, and he says, we still consider ourselves a part of the big church, as he referred it to. He says, we consider that they have strayed away from what we consider essential teachings, but we still look upon them as a legitimate church, but we're hoping to bring about reform or change from within, you know, even though we're separate. And it's interesting because the FLDS Church, on the other hand, doesn't maintain that position. They maintain that the solid church is apostatized and have nothing to do with it. In fact, they don't have anything to do with any of the other groups. They consider themselves the true church, and their prophet, of course, is Warren Jeffs. Whereas I think even the what is known as the Centennial Park group, a group that has broken away from the FLDS and under the leadership of a fellow by the name of Timson, they have their own community that's a little bit to the south and to the west of Colorado City, and they don't go quite as far as saying that we completely reject the Utah Church, although they tend to go a little bit further than what the All Red group does in denouncing what they consider the heresy or heretic behavior of the Utah Church, or the LDS Church.
And it seems that these guys constantly are infighting, and, you know, we have, like, Irville LeBaron and the murders and Singer and Swaps and the raids, and it seems like they're constantly having trouble with the law.
Yeah, they're kind of the nutcase. The LeBarons, Irville LeBaron, and he was a pathologically violent, and there was a history of mental illness or mental instability within the LeBaron family itself, and so they're considered sort of a loose cannon group, you know. And they've actually fragmented into several different groups. Not even, you know, within that one family can they even agree. And then, of course, the other controversial one is the one down in the one down in Mantine. I'm trying to think of the
TLC Church.
Yeah, right.
The true and living Church of Jesus Christ of Saints of the Last Days.
Yeah, that group is engaged in some controversial kind of behavior. And then there's the Kingston group up in northern Utah that has had some issues as well.
Yeah, the Kingstons are kind of fascinating. thing, because they are right there in the heart of Zion, you know, right in Bountiful, and they control a lot of property, a lot of...
Right.
If you get a bail bond in Utah, you're probably dealing with a polygamist by and by. they control
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're pretty flush with money. I mean, it's an interesting group. I've always been, you know, I haven't looked at that group all that carefully, but what's fascinating is that they've had you know, problems with accusations of child abuse and stuff like that, but yet on the other hand, they've been very sagacious and I guess very talented as business entrepreneurs.
Yes, that's my opinion.
And also, you know, as a example of, you know, this kind of modern adaptation of a cooperative owning of property and businesses and things like that, I was surprised to learn that when members in the 70s, members of the RLDS Church were working on building a new Zion community, they actually invited representatives from the Kingston Church out to advise them on how to make a successful cooperative or whatever. I was kind of surprised that there's that connection, because I mean, of course, the RLDS people have always been so you know, opposed to polygamy. That was their number one thing. It was essentially the churches, in a lot of ways, founded by, you know, Emma Smith, who was a major opponent of polygamy. And yet, I guess everybody had to admit, the Kingstons know how to have a successful cooperative. So.
Yeah, it shows that Mormonism makes strange bedfellows, no pun intended. Maybe it was. I'm sorry. That's terrible.
Well, gentlemen, the hour has flown by. It's been an interesting overview, and I know that we were just sort of scratching the surface. We didn't even get to my favorite, the Godbeites.
The Godbeites and the Morrisites, we didn't even talk about them. And there's, you know, major books and major work that's being done on those groups. And they, of course, were schismatic groups in Utah even before the major schism over polygamy in the late 19th century. And yeah.
All right, so maybe we'll have to have you on again later and sort of explore these things in more detail. I think we just scratched the surface.
We'd love to.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Newell and John, thanks again. Let's see, your book is...
Scattering the Schism Within Mormonism. And, I mean, you can the best place for people to get it is Amazon.com. So.
We'll be sure to put that link on our website. So,
yeah, like always, the links will be on our website, and the discussion continues there. And you can call and leave a message at 801-906-6722 or leave an email at mail@mormonexpression.com.